Ladies and gentlemen, this evening we start the spring series of lectures in the Vancouver Institute, Saturday evening lectures. You would have seen the brochure outside as you came, and if you were a member, in fact, you would have received it in the mail. It will show that we have some 10 lectures arranged now, and I think our program chairman and the committee are to be congratulated again. It looks like a very interesting series. In that brochure, you will have noticed a pink card. And that card speaks of financial matters. It tells us that we can't put on lectures without some financial support. The brochure has a membership application. The pink card tells you that beyond membership, there are donations that are welcome. So I would urge you, as if you are not already a member, that you consider seriously supporting us by becoming a member. The membership fees are modest, $15 for a family membership and $10 for a single membership. So please bear that in mind. Our speaker this evening is Mr. Gordon Fairweather. He is a New Brunswicker, born there, educated there, and after service in World War II in the Canadian Navy, he returned there and practiced law for a number of years. In 1952, he turned to provincial politics. He was elected to the legislature in New Brunswick. And in 1958, he became the Attorney General of that province, a post that he held for some 2 years. He then left New Brunswick politics and became a federal politician. And he ran successfully in 1962 and was re-elected on a number of occasions and remained in the House of Commons until 1977. I might say in passing that he was a member of the Conservative Party in these political ventures of his. In all spheres of his activity, he earned the highest reputation for his integrity, his fairness, his soundness of judgment, and his friendliness. In 1977, the ultimate tribute was paid him when the Liberal government appointed him as the first Chief Commissioner of the Human Rights Commission of Canada, which it had then set up. This, of course, was done notwithstanding his political party affiliation. As the Chief Commissioner, he has earned the admiration of Canadians. He's conducted himself with great distinction. And in 1982, he was reappointed for a second term for 7 years. His contributions to Canadian life have been recognized by his being made an officer of the Order of Canada. And incidentally, he has been given some 4 honorary degrees by Canadian universities. It's with the greatest pleasure, therefore, that we at this university and the members of the Vancouver Institute welcome him this evening, and we now look forward to hearing him speak on the year of Orwell and human rights. Mr. Fairweather.
of Orwell, we have to get ourselves properly rigged. Am I properly rigged? Can people hear? If not, we'll tighten the string and try to do better. It's a great pleasure, Mr. President, to be at this university campus. The other day you honored Norman Mackenzie, who is a Maritimer, you know, and also started his university presidency career at the University of New Brunswick. I understand it was a fine dinner for a very great international person. When Mrs. Nemetz first invited me to address the Vancouver Institute and reflect on human rights in the year of Orwell, I was simply delighted by the proposal. But I have to confess that as time went by and pieces on Orwell seemed to be appearing almost every other day, either in the press or on radio, on television, I became somewhat intimidated. I was alarmed that we were drowning in analysis of Orwell. My friends behind their monitoring screens at the Ministry of Truth tell me that they can't scan a university without seeing academics queuing up to read papers on Orwell, and the journalists are hunched over their word processors, and isn't that a nice Orwellian phrase, churning out copy, about 1984. What could I possibly find to say that might be fresh and would also be original? Also, George Woodcock, one of the great figures of Canadian literature, lives among you in British Columbia. Here's a man who was a friend to Orwell as well as his biographer. As though the crystal spirit weren't enough, Woodcock has written a touching and illuminating memoir of Orwell for Quest magazine. With pieces like this to remind us who the real authorities on Orwell are, who am I to bring coals to your Newcastle? Be that as it may, I was invited to speak, I accepted, and here I am. And here we are, 28 days into the infamous year. I don't know about you, but I don't feel very different from the way I felt in 1983. Canada is still a free country, thank God, and Canadians are still a free people, as much as it's possible to be free in this age of television and other mass media. Now, since I don't really equate Madison Avenue with Big Brother, I don't think that he's watching us today. Decima, Mr. Lou Harris, and Dr. Gallup might know what we're thinking, but I don't think really that Big Brother does. All of which isn't to say that Eric Arthur Blair, George Orwell, is not extremely relevant to the age in which we live. Mention Orwell, and two works, of course, come to our minds, don't they? Animal Farm and 1984. The very word Orwellian has entered the language as a synonym for totalitarian. As George Woodcock has pointed out, however, Orwell was not a prophet. He did warn, but he didn't predict. Even his pen name has for most people become a word of dread that dramatically expresses the fears of contemporary Western man. The word Orwellian has become so loosely associated with all kinds of negative features that it's widely used without any regard at all to what Orwell actually said. Now, I didn't accept this invitation. Promoting myself as a literary critic or a social historian. So I don't want to put myself out on a limb, although I have some things that are fairly far out on the limb that I'll get to in a minute. But this speech has given me Mrs. Nemetz, a wonderful opportunity to read and reread Orwell and to reflect on the man and his work. In a way, Orwell was both the beneficiary and the victim of his times. The Cold War was quite warm in 1949 when 1984 appeared. The novel was certainly timely, and it sold 50,000 hardcover copies in Great Britain and some 360,000 in the United States. And then just the other day, as I suppose we might have expected, I read that the book is again a bestseller. It's number one on the paperback in the New York Times list last week, and I suppose it'll be the same this week. And about 50,000 copies a day are being sold across the United States this year. Just as Orwellian has been misapplied to the vision of an automated and robotized world, and these things really were the world of H.G. Wells and Laro Capek, or to the birth of test tube babies, it wasn't Orwell at all, it was Aldous Huxley. Orwell himself felt that 1984 was popular for all the wrong reasons. In the United States, more so than in Britain, the work was interpreted as an attack on socialism in general and on Russian communism in particular. It is a fact well documented in biographies that Orwell was upset at this response to 1984. He didn't write the novel as a Cold War tract, and he was so angered at its reception in the United States that he refused to see a correspondent from Time magazine. I presume he wasn't the first to do that. But the Time journalist had come all the way to England to interview him. Incidentally, this important fact wasn't included in the recent Time cover story about George Orwell. At any rate, 1984 was praised in the United States and condemned in the Soviet Union for the same reasons. It was read and interpreted as a Cold War polemic, and understandably so. As often the case, an author's intentions do not count for very much when his work falls into a reader's hands. Orwell himself was a lifelong person of the left, although he was a staunch anti-communist, or as he would have put it, an anti-Stalinist. He fought in a brigade made up of anarchists and socialists in Spain and considered himself a socialist until the day he died. In the words of Orwell's close friend, the American critic Philip Rov, 1984 was written as an antidote to the totalitarian disease, whether totalitarianism should arise on the right or on the left. And despite the ambassador of the United States to the United Nations, there can be totalitarians of the right and the left. She hasn't figured that out yet, but I think the rest of us have. Orwell himself said that the danger lies in the structure imposed on the socialist and on liberal capitalist countries by the necessity to prepare for total war with the USSR. In other words, 1984 was written on speculation regarding what might happen if the polarizing trends of the Cold War continued and intensified, forcing Britain and the United States to mobilize against the Soviet Union. The United States conservatives sponsored the book, and they claimed Orwell as one of their own, even though he wasn't. Neoconservatives, such as Norman Podritz, argue that were Orwell alive today, he would also be a sort of neoconservative. And it occurred to me that perhaps the Fraser Institute would like to send him a complimentary membership. Aren't they in charge in British Columbia? That isn't in the text. I've been naughty. I'm sorry. In the words of George Woodcock, Orwell was indeed a spokesman for the radical anti-communism, but from an anarchist or a left perspective. I quote Woodcock again, "What shocked Orwell about events in Spain was not merely the use by communists controlled by Russian agents of Stalinist-style torture and relentless interrogation to break down the will of an opponent before destroying him, but also the way in which they manipulated the press in order to distort public perceptions of the truth, first by deliberately misrepresenting what happened, and second by inventing a kind of language intended to baffle rather than inform." This, I'm sure, was the germ of one of Orwell's key ideas in 1984. But we certainly don't have to look back to the Spanish Civil War or to the Soviet Union to find examples of this sort of thing. We don't have to go to Eastern Europe for them either. People who follow, as I do, threats to our free press recall Britain's strict controls on reporting during the Falklands War, or the manipulations of the United States press during the invasion of Grenada. A further example that springs to everyone's mind, surely, is President Reagan's dubbing of the MX missile as the peacekeeper. Pure Orwell. Orwell was passionately committed to liberty, yet he saw no contradiction whatever with calling himself a socialist. Just before he died, he wrote, "Every line of serious work that I've written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism as I understand it." Now, contrast this with a bit of recent purple prose from Mr. William Buckley's National Review. He wrote, "The forces of darkness have huge armies, a bigger and better arsenal, liberation movements, and the horror's allegiance. The forces of light have Orwell on their side and draw strength from it." As I said, Orwell is claimed by both left and right. And I think that what this shows more than anything is that we cut our arguments and choose our evidence to suit our preconceived ideas. We take our positions first, and then find evidence to bolster them. I think we're more faithful to Orwell if we read him simply as an anti-totalitarian who was repelled by both Stalin and Hitler. Orwell was a highly principled intellectual, and he abhorred totalitarianism, among other things, because it relies on the falsification of ideas. Totalitarianism has abolished freedom of thought to an extent unheard of in any other age. The totalitarian state tries to control the thoughts and emotions of its subject, at least as completely as it controls their actions. Orwell's concern for thoughts and emotions was linked to his love for literature and his love for words. He cared passionately about words, and he insisted that they be used precisely and plainly. In his own phrase, a rather lovely one, he said he tried to write prose like a window pane. How many do it today in our newspapers? Where is the prose today that's written like a window pane? One of his great fears was that if the world became totalitarian, literature as we know it would come to an end. Now, before Edwin Newman and before William Safire, Orwell was concerned with the deterioration of language, especially as it related to the deterioration of the political process. As it happens, my favorite essay of George Orwell is Politics and the English Language. He was writing about England, of course, in 1946, but somehow his words seem to echo down the years. They seem quite relevant today. Political language has come to consist largely of euphemism question begging and sheer cloudy vagueness, he said. Or in another line, the great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there's a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns as if it were instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms, like a cuttlefish squirting out ink. Recognize any politicians you know? I'm not so bold as to confess here, but we'll leave that for the tea afterwards. Orwell despised the misuse of language for political purposes. You all know the slogans written in Newspeak from 1984. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. As Orwell wrote, when the general atmosphere is bad, language must suffer. Perhaps this is really the sign that Canada has finally entered the age of Orwell. We're not actually living in a totalitarian society, of course, but certainly if the language of our political discourse gives us a standard, we are indeed living in a bad atmosphere. In Orwell's terms, our political life is in danger of becoming a mass of lies, evasions, folly, hatred, and schizophrenia. This is one of the things that I find a bit disquieting, and I hope I don't really ask you to forgive me, but please try to understand me. I am disquieted about recent political events here in that part of my country called British Columbia. And I don't accept for one minute that one who doesn't happen to live here doesn't have a thought about this province. And if I need another excuse, I have a couple of grandchildren living across the straits in Sydney. That's enough of an authentication, I guess, isn't it? But I've been in politics for a long time, and I'm familiar and comfortable with the give and take or cut and thrust of political argument. Since Canada is not a one-party state, thank God, a major forum of parliament is to provide a forum for debate. But that debate should be civilized, a civilized debate carried out for the good of the people that parliament and legislatures exist to serve. I firmly believe that ideas and not personalities should be the contenders. Now, as head of the Canadian Human Rights Commission, I'm obliged to keep aloof from partisan politics, and I'll do that. But I'm troubled by what's gone on in the legislature of this province. In the 1890s, Sir John Bourinot wrote in Parliamentary Procedure and Practice in the Dominion of Canada as follows: "The principles at the basis of English parliamentary law have been always kept steadily in view by the Canadian Parliament. These are to protect a minority and to restrain the improvidence of tyranny of a majority. But to secure the transaction of public business in an orderly manner, to enable every member to express his opinion within the limits necessary to preserve decorum and prevent unnecessary waste of time, and to prevent any legislative action being undertaken on a sudden impulse." Nothing has changed since Sir John, of the principles, I have to hasten to add, since Bourinot, the great authority on parliamentary practice, wrote these words almost 100 years ago. But I suppose we could use this quotation to identify one or two transgressors from both sides of the political fence. Some of the debate surrounding the July 7 proposals degenerated to little more than posturing and name-calling. More upsetting to me, though, was what seemed to be a perversion of the very role of Parliament itself. That is, the genuine debate was not taking place within the legislature. The real debate, or of crucial importance to the people of British Columbia, and I believe to the people of Canada was being carried out between institutes on the one hand, who seemed to be the advisors to the government, and the Solidarity Coalition on the other. The politicians seemed at best to be mouthpieces for ideas and arguments developed outside the legislature. Thus, in a very real sense, the people of British Columbia were going unrepresented in the most important political debate in decades. With regard to the legislation that was introduced among the flurry of bills on July 7th, the one that most concerned me was obviously the proposal to eviscerate the British Columbia Human Rights Commission and branch. And I am delighted and say so publicly that the Minister of Labour has since announced that the bill will be allowed to die on the order paper and be reintroduced, I hope in drastically altered form, sometime in the future. But if Bill 27 had gone through, I state without any exaggeration that the abolition of the British Columbia Human Rights Commission would have had serious impact on Canada's image abroad. Specifically, Canada has committed itself with the unanimous approval of every province of this country to international obligations with regard to human rights under instruments such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, by which a signatory undertakes to provide protection from discrimination in a variety of prescribed grounds, or for a variety of prescribed grounds. The British Columbia human rights legislation fulfilled these obligations, and thus you were part of Canada's overall response to a treaty. The enactment of Bill 27 would have been perceived by many in the international community as a regressive step contrary to Canada's international commitments. Bill 27 wounds us all. It would have done great harm in a general sense as well. I think it isn't exaggerated to say that Canada has a good reputation among developing countries. Our credibility in the international community is based in large degree on the extent to which we practice equality and legislate against discrimination. As a result, Canada has played and continues to play an extremely valuable role in the world community as a mediator between the developed and less developed countries. This role would have been severely jeopardized if we were perceived as backtracking on human rights. Bill 27 was part of the immense legislative package that was in effect dumped into the legislative mill after your most recent election. It was an extremely important bill with numerous implications, as I've said. It was a piece of legislation that could have affected every person in this province and which would have signaled a dramatic turnaround in the political and philosophical direction of British Columbia. Any bill which attempts to roll back the human rights protections which Canadians have enshrined in their legislation is, in effect, an attempt to rewrite the social contract. Obviously, Canadians and British Columbians, as part of the whole, their governments are entitled to rewrite the social contract. Do it if they so choose, but only after the widest possible consultation and discussion. During that discussion, all concerned surely are entitled to be a party. There was no mention during your election that legislation such as Bill 27 was pending. Now, I'm not arguing that the human rights code in this province didn't need reform. Indeed, the commission itself recognized this in a variety of reports to the government of British Columbia and to the Legislative Assembly. While I'm very glad that there's to be time for reflection about the future of human rights in British Columbia and that the ministers agreed to consult on amendments to strengthen and improve the legislation, I regret that meanwhile the human rights branch remains with a skeleton staff, and that's an understatement, and much uncertainty about what's to come. I felt comfortable speaking freely tonight, but I don't think I'm being partisan. I don't wish to be partisan. I'm speaking of structure and process and not really of content. The reason we're not in a totalitarian society, the reason why we have freedoms and respect for human rights, is that we have institutions like parliament and legislatures where issues can be debated in full public view. We have elections so that people can know where their prospective representatives stand on issues and then let the votes follow accordingly. Anything that erodes these processes and institutions brings us a step closer to totalitarianism, a step closer to the dark world that Orwell warned us about. I'm not speaking against any point of view. I'm speaking against the undermining of the institutions that guarantee our freedoms. Our society has become extremely polarized these days, and this is the case right across the country. Tolerance for opposing views is in very short supply, and this is bad for democracy. The debate over the relative balance of liberty and equality in our society has been going on, after all, for hundreds of years, and it will probably continue into the foreseeable future. If Canadians wish to argue the balance between the concept of freedom and the proper role of government in society, fine. This is one of the fundamental political questions. If we wish to debate the role of trade unions in a free enterprise society, fine. Or the role of Crown corporations, or Petro-Canada, or creeping socialism, or subsidized freight rates, or disarmament and foreign policy. Let's have spirited debates, but civilized debates, that respect the honor and good intentions of the participants. Let us respect the integrity of our electoral and parliamentary institutions. Now, Canada has come a long way with regard to safeguarding human rights. Every province and the government of Canada has a Human Rights Act or code. Our new constitution has enshrined protection for human rights and guarantees those rights to women, to all religions, to all races, to the elderly, and to the mentally and physically disabled. This is a very important and, I think, an extraordinarily good thing. It all comes down to the question of the type of society we want to live in, that we want our children to live in. Canada is, after all, the great plural country of the world. Pluralism and diversity are our key words. Our citizens come from so many races and belong to so many religions. Your own province of British Columbia is the perfect example of this. And I, for one, find this diversity invigorating and welcome it. Institutions and legal instruments such as human rights commissions and codes are our society's way of providing the flexibility that our varied and pluralistic population requires. Canadians look around the world and see other societies torn apart by tragic sectarian violence and bloodshed, and are thankful that our democratic institutions give us the means to live in peace and harmony with among neighbors. They give us the means to live with one another even when we disagree, and disagree strongly. The commission that I head has a limited mandate in employment to the federal government itself and to industries that fall under federal regulations, such as banking and interprovincial transportation, and in access to goods, services, and facilities in a considerably broader spectrum. Yet despite any jurisdictional limitation, the very existence of a Canadian Human Rights Commission creates a resonance that extends far beyond any legal purview. A Human Rights Commission fulfills a very symbolic function whose importance can't be underestimated. It signals to those who expect to be left out to those who expect to be left out but who are entitled to all the benefits of citizenship, that Canada knows about them, cares about them, and will give them a fair hearing. All too often, the needs of these Canadians aren't noticed by very many of us. Some have argued that human rights safeguards are an impingement upon freedom. This argument doesn't impress me, of course. Human rights safeguards are a constant on freedom, or a constraint rather on freedom, only in that they limit a person's freedom to unjustly discriminate against others, to prevent them from attaining their full potential as human beings. In other words, political and institutional power, economic wealth, and the growth of understanding through education and experience are positive sources of freedom. The absence of these things is as much an impediment to freedom as is direct coercion. The purpose of Canadian human rights legislation in province or in nation is to guarantee all Canadians access to them. If this means change, then surely we support change. I think that our society is better off because opportunity knows no boundaries of sex or color. And as a patriot, I welcome this sort of change. It's fully within our best traditions. I don't think that those who might attempt to prevent such change or who hope to roll back the tide will be very successful. In this process of change, unfortunately, it's those of us who are in the middle who are made to feel most uncomfortable. I have a confession. I claim membership in that uniquely Canadian body, the Radical Center. I've been also tempted occasionally. It is tempting, you know, once in a while, to the safety of fundamentalism, of religion, or of ideology. Absolutism would be so much easier, wouldn't it? So much wearing on our minds. However, I'm uncomfortable with the absolutist search for moral certainty, with the belief that anyone can be 100% right 100% of the time. George Steiner's lovely phrase, nostalgia for the absolute. Nostalgia for the absolute, for a mythic past that never really existed. It can't be a substitute for the real struggle. And our society is in a struggle to better itself. The gains we've made in the human rights field are part of that struggle. Great truths, the poet said, are greatly won, not found by chance. Now, what's been called the rush to deregulate is part of this regressive nostalgia for absolutes. When I go into a restaurant, I'm glad that there are health and sanitation codes which pertain to restaurants. They impinge on somebody's freedom. The freedom of the restaurant owner, but they protect the public freedom and the right to uncontaminated food. What an easy out it is to set up government and regulations as fall guys instead of recognizing the real problem, and that is the complexity and difficulty of modern living. In most cases, regulations are a response to that complexity, not the cause of it. How is the average citizen to respond to the thousands upon thousands of chemical substances that are on the market? Do regulations protect the citizen or limit his freedom? Would you be more or less comfortable investing in an unregulated stock market? If anybody remembers that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, after all, was one of the great conservatives, and saved capitalism by regulating an unregulated stock market. The libertarian right speaks a great deal of turning to the good old days of laissez-faire. But going back to the building of our transcontinental railroad, I can't recall a single instance of absolute laissez-faire in Canadian history. And anybody who says otherwise doesn't know Canadian history. Further, we often forget that regulations are frequently called for by industry itself, which turns to government to restore public confidence in a product. Who could forget the American regulations? Were they so special? Regulations calling for tamper-proof medicine containers after the Tylenol case. What did they do? They all trotted to government. The big companies trotted off to the government and the regulators and said, save us from ourselves. And a regulator responded, and as I understand it, when I opened my Tylenol, nobody has tampered with it. I haven't thought or said a word about the regulator who gave me a safe bottle of Tylenol. But some people would wind the whole thing down and go back. I don't know what they'd do. They'd be dangerous, wouldn't they? That's what they do. But regulations should be simply drafted and subject to periodic review. And yes, the fewer the better. But in many fields, such as environmental protection and human rights, regulations enhance our freedoms. We have human rights legislation because of overwhelming evidence that certain sectors of our society were not getting their fair share, and that this was a situation which with all the best intentions in the world wouldn't change. And the regulations came, I mean, I'm very old-fashioned. They came from a rule of Parliament, unanimously adopted. It wasn't any backdoor imposition of regulations. It was a bill that had public scrutiny, public debate, and so on. So it's well and good to speak of returning to the days of old Adam Smith, but let's recall what 18th century plumbing was like. The days of laissez-faire were also the days of child labor and the 60-hour work week. And some of the excuses I hear for returning seem to me to be copied from just those days. Susan and Martin Tolchin have written, regulation is the connective tissue of a civilized society. As technological and scientific advances lead us into unknown worlds with unimaginable dangers, society needs more protection, not less. This means more government regulation, intelligently crafted, skillfully managed, and sensitively enforced. In our modern and complex society, I think it's a serious mistake to see behind every regulation the hand of Big Brother. The days when Canada was a fiefdom of the family compact are long gone. Yet we still have our monarchy and we still have our institutions. They have given us the stability we need and have also proven their value by being adaptable and amenable to change. Human rights protection is a demonstration of that flexibility, yet is squarely within our tradition of protecting the sanctity of the individual. I don't think we'd be better off if, under the guise of a fashionable rightist libertarianism, we were to eschew the basic concepts of tolerance and pluralism. I don't think that Canadians of whatever political beliefs are willing to give up the society they have built here in favor of an alien cowboy capitalism. You see, it is different. We are different. We have to understand that we're different from the cowboy capitalists. We never have been cowboy capitalists in this country. You'll be glad to know this polemic is just about finished. But I want to quote Charles Taylor from his book, Radical Tories. While conservatives had always favored a limited role for government in the tradition of Macdonald, they were never afraid to use the power of the state for the national good. And they did not place private enterprise on a pedestal. While conservatives stressed the importance of order, this meant not merely law and order, but also social order. In turn, this implied concern for the poor and disadvantaged, concern for the environment, and concern for economic growth. I don't believe in magic. In the late 60s, the left claimed to have all the solutions. Now the right says they know what to do. I don't think they'll be any more successful than the left was. I'm content to make hay slowly, utilizing the institutions and traditions that we have and have served us so well. As we enter this year of Orwell, we Canadians should realize how blessed we are. The repetition is almost embarrassing, isn't it, of material things and education and our open-heartedness. I even suggest, without any chauvinism, that we have now a Canadian civilization, but that's another speech. Our institutions are stable. Our traditions of freedom and tolerance are well established. If we exercise vigilance and will, we'll be able to preserve George Orwell's 1984. Orwell was such a freedom lover. How ironic that the adjective Orwellian has come to mean tyrannical. If it were to accurately reflect the man, Orwellian would mean democratic or freedom-loving. If Canada is ever called an Orwellian society, I hope that it will be in this sense of the word. In a sentence from 1984 that could well serve as his epitaph, George Orwell wrote, "There was truth and there was untruth. And if you clung to the truth even against the whole world, you were not mad." Thank you very much.
Fairweather is willing to answer questions, so I now open the meeting to that. One over here.
The questioner has an allegation that he has suffered for 18 years from having his activities and speech and conversations monitored, and he asks me who he should go to if MLAs and police and others ignore him. This is a fairly sweeping charge to make. There is in this province, of course, independent of the whims of the government majority, an ombudsman. I don't know whether the questioner has been to the ombudsman, but he might well want to take that route.
Another question?
Yes.
Would you explain the implications of the what I think is called the non-obstant clause, that notwithstanding Section 33 in the Canadian Bill of Rights and Freedoms, it gives, as I understand it, the provinces the specific power to opt out of that, especially in light of, you know, recent events, potential legislation. The
The non-abstante clause was the price that the government and the provinces were prepared to pay to get an agreement on a charter and an amended constitution. I think what we should watch is whether governments resort to a non-abstante. In the work in which I'm involved, we watch carefully. We sort of have little tick marks against attorneys general and their names, rather. We don't monitor. We only monitor their mouths. But a good many of them have given undertakings in public not to resort to the notwithstanding. Yes, that to some, that non-abstante is an imperfection in the Constitution. I would rather think that in most cases, by the way, the government of Canada could resort to it too, that route, if it wished. I can't imagine it after, the publicity surrounding the patriation and so on. But I think that's as fair as I can be an explanation of why the notwithstanding clause is there. It's really a bow to the legislatures that in a very long tradition in this country and in England, the legislature was supreme, and we are sort of backing in to a charter situation or a constitution that means that the judges and not the legislators will be the ultimate deciders. I'm embarrassed. There's so many experts in this room. I'm trying to give a general explanation for the non-abstante clause that'll... It's very much better than the first version, I'm very glad to say. At the Canadian Human Rights Commission, there's an amendment, a consequential amendment to our act, which we're pleased about because we have been worried for years that those who've been denied security clearances for one reason or another never know the reason for the denial. The bill will give a route and a process involving elements at last of fairness. Up to now, there has been no fairness in this aspect of government. But I haven't analyzed each section of the bill. I myself favor a civilian security service, provided that an elected parliamentary, a minister, is responsible. I thought the last bill was an extraordinarily silly idea because the director would run it and nobody would be accountable. That is quite, to me, the antithesis of what we believe in as part of as support as a responsible government. The bill is much better. It's the only piece of briefing I allowed myself. I suspected that I'd hear about that bill. It was not a bill of the government, but the government introduced it, but I think it should be said in fairness that it was unanimously approved by Parliament. It was a parliamentary bill. It does not prevent single-issue people from advertising and pamphleteering and discussing. What it does do is prevent them from saying Gordon Fairweather, candidate in Fundy Royal, New Brunswick, is faulty because he supports this or that or the other. If the single interest group that this bill purports to regulate takes on a candidate in person, that is, names him, then the bill suggests that the group should enter the fray. They can't have it both ways. The candidates, and I think this is a major reform in the last 15 years, are now subject to a ceiling on expenditure. And so that if a single interest group wants to take on a candidate by name, out here, Carney or Fraser or Robinson or whoever they may be, they have to register and be part of the political process. They can, however, espouse their cause as vigorously as they wish, but not by taking on in person the candidates for the various parties. Now, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, I think the chief electoral officer and Parliament was extraordinarily inept in explaining the damage they were trying to deal with in the bill. That's my explanation. I think there's some worries that the newspapers won't be able to endorse. The bill is so loosely drawn that newspapers will not be able to endorse parties by name. And the chief electoral officer suggested an amendment. That's an explanation. I just got this out of the clipping service because I knew of the disquiet. I myself have never spoken to the chief electoral officer. I'm nervous about listening to the Citizens Coalition as espousing justice and freedom in this country. I'd like to hear from some other actors. Well, I'm now going to be private and personal and not chief commissionery. I mean, that's impossible, I know. But I think to deny a foreign student an education in this country is the most curious way of dealing with our international obligations and is self-defeating. Everywhere I used to go as a member of parliament, I would meet people in many, many countries across the world who had been in Canada for their post-secondary education. It was as if you had put in pumps to get clear water. And look, we are not now, are we, at the limit of our educational resources that we can't admit? A good many of them come under CETA sponsorship. I think it's mean, and I think it's self-defeating, and I'm sorry that many provinces, including the one in which I live now, have seen fit to limit foreign students. And even in England, they're doing it. It's retrogressive. Of course, in practical terms, it hasn't anything to do with the Canadian Human Rights Commission, but we're citizens. I watch it with despair. Now, what we can do about it is raise Cain or any other raising you like to do. Yes, sir.
Our commission, as it exists in D.C., works to
The Quebec Human Rights Commission reports direct to the National Assembly of Quebec. We route through the Minister of Justice. I have served six Ministers of Justice, six parliaments, and had my chits signed by six ministers, and never once has a Minister of Justice for Canada interfered with. I'm sure we annoyed them to no end. If we didn't annoy them, they should have sent us home. But yes, indeed, it would be better. I was told in the middle of this noise out here about Bill 27 that your Minister of Labor felt burdened because he had 600 files on his desk. I told the person who told me of this terrible news that the Minister of Justice for Canada hadn't a single complaint file on his desk, and it might, that was the way to change the commission, to get it off the minister's desk. But we could discuss this later.
I'd like to challenge the Section 170 of the Criminal Code, it's nudity in a public place.
Well, goodness sake, I haven't had a three-piece suit on for weeks, but I put it on for the people of British Columbia to show. To show you what a staid old Tory I am. But look, yeah, I... But I don't think it's a matter of criminal code. I think it's a matter of politeness, isn't it?
Right.
Well, I mean...
No, it's a matter of ignorance.
No, not always.
It's a matter of learning.
Well,
it's a matter of ignorance. If you have a question. And it's a matter of war and peace also.
Oh, wow, goodness sake.
Next question.
And it's a matter of peace.
Yes?
Is the government now restrained from bringing down the War Measures Act as it did back in 1970?
I'm not thoroughly prepared, not prepared actually. The undertaking made some years ago was that Canada have a new War Measures Act. Presumably, an invocation of the War Measures Act would have to come within Section 1 to be seen to be demonstrably reasonable. But we haven't had a new War Measures Act. I saw just on the way out here that some spokesperson for the government said we were to have a new Official Secrets Act. It's all the same game. Our act is an act of copied from England in 1914. England changed theirs. We haven't got around to it yet.
Supposing that the leader of the opposition in the federal parliament were to challenge the chair on a ruling and then, in dispute, the chair would order that the leader of the opposition be dragged out of the House, what would be the rules and conventions that could be referred to deal with that problem?
I think you and I are good friends. I think that's unfair. No, I have my views of the stupidity that went on in the Legislative Assembly of this province, and I hope to God that civilized people can deal with it, and that the pickiness. I mean, this is a legislature. I am appalled by it, and I would hope that gracefulness and civility would prevail on both sides, and the person who is the leader of the opposition will be able to return and do his to perform his functions, but don't get me into this one. I have quite high blood pressure, and it goes up when...
How many people are entitled to come to the Human Rights Commission for protection? I was disturbed the other day to read that one of the unruly prisoners who was in there and who had committed a violent act, had been put into solitary, he was going to object to it on the basis of inhuman treatment and appeal to the Human Rights Commission. Now, there must be a limit.
Well, there's no limit if there are complaints. I could tell you in rough figures about 26,000 inquiries come a year. Many, many thousands of those have nothing whatever to do. They're requests for information and so on. We have in this country a correctional investigator. We have a good many letters from inmates, and we route those complaints to the correctional investigator who does an independent investigation. The first correctional investigator was a graduate of this university, Inger Hansen, and now is the commissioner for information, freedom of information. But just because somebody says, look, somebody wrote to me the other day because they couldn't get a certificate of airworthiness on an airplane they built in their backyard, I was intrigued by the letter, but I was able to say that neither Charter of Rights or Human Rights Code could make an unsafe plane safe. I do a lot of that kind of mail.
Now, it seems to me that we all have considerable pride and confidence in the Canadian Human Rights Commission, but your suggestion that the regulations of government can be controlled by bodies such as this seems to me somewhat optimistic. After all, we should remember that the greatest crime against human rights in this century was the murder of 6 million Jews by the agents of a government. And you seem to me are rather optimistic if you assume that more agents of a government are going to be able to control such things in the future. Is there not a contradiction philosophically between having the powers of a government controlled by yet another agency of government?
Well, am I being asked to equate Canada in 1984 with the totalitarian state that murdered 6 million Jews? I mean,
it's the power of the bureaucracy.
It wasn't the bureaucracy that... It was the bureaucracy were the agents of Hitler and his minions, but they were...
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I'm not treating this question lightly. How could anybody treat this question as lightly? But I'm talking about regulations on a much more mundane topic than that. I'm unable to make the philosophical leap. I'm sorry.
Comment on provincial political affairs at great length. Are you doing that in your private capacity?
I'm doing that as a Canadian who cares deeply that 1/10 of my country has taken a course of action, that's all. I tried in the speech to make rather clear that I singled out, there are 27 bills, I picked the one that I know something about. And I did it as Chief Commissioner of the Canadian Human Rights Commission because I grieve at what is happening in this province. My statute? Yes. My statute asks me to comment when in Canada things that affect the liberties and entitlements of Canadians are in hazard, as they are in this province, when the commission has been wound down and a council, as I understand it, but I said, I'm glad that the minister has had second thoughts. Is it ultra-virus for a Canadian to speak about what's happening in his country? No, no, we're not interfering. We're speaking out. I wish Manitoba had done what my province of New Brunswick had done. That's what should be done in Manitoba. And I'm proud that New Brunswick was the first officially bilingual province in our country. That's my comment. But you see, I'm talking about provincial politics. It's ultra vires. To use a phrase of Eugene Forsey, tear the purple off the clouds. And my friend who is upset about me would, I think, have a legitimate beef if the Minister of Justice for Canada, disallowance, I guess, is there, but I don't know any government. I can't imagine it being used. But that could lead into another conversation, but I don't really want to start it. Yeah.
Well, we'll have this last question there.
Thanks. Firstly, Mr. Fairweather, I'd like to thank you personally for your openness in sharing your genuine views, because that was very helpful. My question is, I'm sorry, fourfold. The first one deals with the new CSIS bill. Does the new CSIS bill recognize the primacy of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms plus of the statute, the Canadian Companion to the Rights Act? The second point is, Do you see a spread of Bill 27s or quasi-Bill 27s across Canada and or the United States? And if so, or what can members of the general public do about it? And the third and last point is, do you perceive the word restraint to be part of a useful vocabulary?
Well, let's take the last first. I thought restraint was the perfect Orwellian, but I was too polite ever to have put it in my speech. I thought people would go up the aisles and leave. Of course, it's Orwellian. It's superb in terms of having everybody jump on, or many people, not most people here, thank God, but many people are seduced by words like restraint. That's the third question. The second question, no. As a matter of fact, the province of Alberta has substantially increased its education component in the Alberta Human Rights Commission bill, a substantial increase. I think some of that came about because of the infamous Keekstra affair, but other preoccupations of the government of Alberta. I was en route to British Columbia, egregiously meddling in provincial affairs by talking to the Saskatchewan Human Rights Commission, a new commission appointed by a conservative government, not yet seduced by the winds from the Pacific. What else is happening? A new human rights code in Manitoba, a new human rights code in Ontario. No. And look, your Minister of Labor, God bless him, has agreed to withdraw his bill. Now, the CSIS, I presume that bill has to be interpreted in accordance with the Constitution Act of 1981, 1982. But I'm not, I didn't come, that's a pretty, that's a question that's pretty hard for me to deal with at 10 o'clock at night. I don't want to put you off. We might discuss it, or we could exchange letters.
I'll call on Dr. Charles Parris to move over to thank you.
Thank you. Not too close. It's always difficult to be surrounded by tall men, but however, they haven't existed. First of all, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the Vancouver Institute for having invited me to thank Gordon. That's a long way around. Dr. Bourne, thank you. And I will, after all, also go to l'éminence grise, Belle Nemetz, who really graciously twisted my arm to thank Gordon. There is a term in Latin that we call magister, le maître. When I got to know Gordon, it was a term that I thought of not imposing on him, but simply describing him as. And that magister is what education is, light and warmth. He gave it to us this evening, the light was very much a part of his talk, the clarity of language, which I might add was preceded by the clarity of ideas. But for anyone who is in the human rights area, that light, which is spelt out by clarity of language and of thought, must always be tempered by the clarity of humor. And he certainly has it. Finally, there is, in that educational process that is so well epitomized in Gordon's life, warmth. I think we felt it this evening, and I know that as chairperson of the last Human Rights Commission in British Columbia, I personally have felt it along with the other commissioners and the other members of the Human Rights Branch of British Columbia. That fateful morning of July the 8th, having awoken from 2 hours of sleep and still trying to absorb what I had heard on July the 7th in Victoria, ready to catch a plane back to Vancouver. It was 6 o'clock in the morning as I waited for the first flight in front of the Empress Hotel. And I said, where do I turn to now? And I turned for both clarity and warmth to Gordon Fairweather. Thank you very much, Gordon, for this evening and for everything.
That is the end of the meeting. Good night.